I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. Today I'm inviting you to join me in a conversation with a friend. Something truly, truly unscripted, with no target. Something that me and my friends do every now and then as we ponder life, complain a little bit like grumpy old men, and enjoy our time together. My guest today is Jagat Jyoti Khalsa, who I met when I gave the opening keynote to a Tony Robbins event. Tony and Sage blew our minds with how they changed lives in 3 days, but both of us were there to try and play our part and just talk a little bit about what we know. And there he is, Jagat Jyoti, was teaching meditation with his turban, looking like a, if not a guru, then at least a serious yogi. And he has that amazing calm on stage. And yeah, lovely, lovely, lovely soul in every possible way. The next morning after he gave his first practice, we had breakfast together. And man, what a shrewd businessman. He lives in California. He played a big role in many startups, and he, you know, pioneered many concepts in those startups, and you know, basically fully engaged in life. And the dichotomy, if you want, the duality of that beautiful soul, from calm to shrewdness, from spirituality to success in business, from his clear vision sometimes of what he wants to do, to that very gentle, very, very gentle, highly sensitive soul, just captivated me. And we stayed in touch as friends and decided one day we will just chat in front of all of you. So today is the day. I hope you will enjoy my conversation with my dear friend, Jagat Jyoti Khalsa. I have to say, it's been a very strange year.
Yeah?
It has, actually. It's quite... There is, I don't use that word very often, but energetically there is something resisting around this year, I feel, at least with many. Of course, you know, there are global issues and economic issues and so on, but it just seems that everything happening this year, at least in my personal experience, takes one extra attempt, one extra trial. You know, it's just been very... draining, maybe a little, is the word that I would use. So I don't know if you felt the same, but obviously that experience must have been draining you quite a lot.
It was. I also think there's a feeling in our world of this fight that seems to be going. You'd think it's US-based, but it's not. It's this tension between a freedom of expression of human beings and an authoritarianism an authoritarianism, not in a pleasant way. And while we're seeing the global, everything sort of changing, we'll likely see India and China and Russia, Saudi Arabia pairing together to move off of the US currency. We might see this thing and that thing. Like the US is starting to feel like what a shopping mall from the 80s looks like today when you walk through it.
Oh, I cannot agree more, especially for the external eye.
Yeah, and it's not. And so then what happens is then all of a sudden people start going, well, this isn't working. The politics of San Francisco is not working. It's a city of squalor. It's a city of mental illness. It's a city of drug addiction. It's a city of the lowest common denominator getting taken care of without the city's population. You find this in Los Angeles. You're finding it in Portland. You're finding it in Seattle. You're finding and so what people are going is, well, maybe people that wouldn't agree with Republicans or with the authoritarianism or with the rest of the stuff, they start to list over. You see Donald Trump's people voting for him against all of their own interests. And it's a, and you're just like, hey guys, you're going to wake up one time and realize they're just, there's, you will have nothing, nothing. There's not going to, you live someplace. You're not going to have any right to your body. You're not going to have any right to reading books that you want to read. You're not going to have any right to hearing about the history that brought us here. You're not going to have any right for medical treatment. You're not going to have any workman's comp. You're not going to have anything left. And in the end, Mo, you and I will likely, but others may not. And they won't. And so the whole world just feels, it just feels kind of, it's lacking an idealism and a hopefulness that we once had. And the balance of good and bad seemed to be okay. But now the balance seems to be that there's no punishment. There's no reward for good. There's no punishment for bad. There's no shame left in our world, so no one actually gives a thought to their behavior. And I think all of these things just feel yucky. I mean, it's just being in our country just feels kind of yucky. We basically, we have two countries and never twain shall meet.
I mean, I'll share with you this as a very dear friend. So, you know, going to the U.S. for a Middle Eastern like me has been quite a challenge. Since 9/11, right? I've had a valid U.S. visa since I was 11, so, you know, 45 years. And more and more, it became more and more challenging. But I still, every time my visa expired, I would go back and say, okay, it's worth it. You know, so much effort, so much humiliation, unfortunately, because I'm assumed criminal until I prove myself innocent, right? And that's not a nice feeling, especially when you know deep inside that you're trying to do good, right? But anyway, until this last time when I was rejected entry into LA, and then the officers were so generous and they said, look, the typical process would be that we cancel your visa and you can't come again for 5 years. You can't even apply for 5 years, but we're not going to do that. We're going to allow you to apply for another one and so on. And in my mind, I was like, no, I don't think it's worth it this time. Honestly, the opportunity of the U.S. as compared to how far the world has moved. You know, first time I went to the U.S. in the 70s, if you wanted to be anyone, you had to be in the U.S. But today, you know, from an impact point of view, from a business point of view, from a market size point of view, the rest of the world is so massive and the U.S. is shrinking. And it's making everything so difficult that I think it's becoming a hindrance for people to say, why should I go through all of that effort to be in the US? And I think, you know, to back your statement up, sadly, a lot of the symptoms that you talk about in terms of getting away with things, even if they were bad, are, I don't want to sound bad, but there, a lot of them are US exports. The way the world is today has been Americanized very heavily in the last 50 years. You know, the idea of, if it's legal, it's okay. It doesn't have to be ethical, for example. It's one of the things I've been challenged with very seriously, because in IBM years, when I started working in the 80s, you had to do things that were legal and ethical, okay? Mm-hmm. That was the common business practice. You had to do things that were legal because you have to absolutely be legal, and ethical because that wins customers over and makes them feel safe around you and so on and so forth, partners and so on. But I don't think that's the business world we live in anymore. The business world we live in is, if it's legal and we can get away with it, that's wonderful. Let's go for it.
And even if we can't get away with it, we'll just use our court systems to delay, attack, delay until the end. And there was this really interesting man, and he was a bankruptcy attorney based in Oregon. I had the pleasure of meeting a number of years ago. Very elegant, really kind, very gentle man. And he said to me, I learned a great lesson from him. And he said, good people want to solve their problems and bad people want to delay. And he says, the problem that he winds up having is that people show up and like, I just want to solve it. I want to pay this off. I spent the money. I want to pay this. I want to do the best I can. They're all freaked out. He goes, but the other ones, they just want to use the court systems and drag it on and get continuances and take the time. And everything was about time. And we see this of Donald Trump and all the rest around them. Well, I like to call them the projection monkeys. because all they do is project whatever they are onto everybody else. And so if you want to know what they're going to do next, you can just see what they're complaining about today. And that's basically it. And he goes, so start understand time and you'll have a better mastery over stuff. And I realized he was right. Like, just instead of being in a rush to solve everything and to fix it or to get moved past it, just take your time and give it a little space. And I applied it more in my counsel to my friends when I would take the time and say, no, let's give this some space. Let's open this space up. Let's add breath. Let's add some air to this space like as needed, and wait before so quick to try to solve something. But there's no, Americans evidently have exported. When I come back to the United States from travel, someone asked me what it's like to wear a turban. So I don't have the same experience as someone of color or someone have born into the DNA of color and what gets passed on through their experiences throughout our world, throughout their experience in America. So I don't have that experience. I only have my conversion in my early 20s to being a Sikh and then dressing and looking like a Punjabi and a Sikh. But the only people that I worry about when I'm walking around in America are white people, because those are the ones that throw epithets at me, that say something. African-American community never has bothered me with my turban. Partially, they probably think that I'm Muslim, and there's a big Muslim population in the community. Latino families, Spanish-speaking Latino families, Central American, Spanish, South American, et cetera, very respectful always. Partially, I think, because they grow up in households that are generally Catholic and they have a good religious, their parents, and I'm now their parents' age. Yeah. So there's a thing of
religion. Did you notice that?
Yeah. I noticed also the other day that I'm the age that I met my grandparents at when I was a kid.
Don't say those things.
My next step is to hold my pants with one hand and scream, "Hey, you kids, get out of my yard."
I know. I'm thinking of that. Man, that's really life
love
passes
it.
By.
I actually love this age that I'm at. And then from the Asian populations across all of them, whether Vietnamese or Cambodian or Japanese, never, ever a problem. It's white people in America that I wind up getting. When I come back to the United States, customs about 60% of the time just bothers me. No reason. And they're rude. They're just not even like kind. I remember one guy, I had $1,000 worth of tea samples. These were very expensive, come out once a year. We were testing some things for a new line of tea for Yogi. They didn't even open them up. The guy was in such a bad mood, he stuck his knife through every one of them to test for bugs and then just watched them all kind of merge together. And he could not have cared any less about my feelings, the value, my job, nothing. He just
Or the fact like that being, you're not a criminal.
That's right.
This is criminal treatment. Like, he's treating you as if you committed a crime.
That's right. Yeah. And I've had one speeding ticket and one moving violation ticket in my life. And yet that's the, you know, it's like, I remember this guy, he told me he said he had all this money lined up and he showed me his documents and he did this blah, blah, blah. And one thing I realized is he had sent a note to a colleague and said, "Hey, if we get rid of Jagajoti," now meanwhile, I owned the whole business. "If we get rid of me, he's got more investors to come in." Right. So I read this. I realize I have a lot of retail revenue under my belt of things that I've helped to create on as a part of a team, as part of a group with people. So I've done a lot of different products on grocery store shelves. I've created a bunch of different categories or initiated those categories. I've scaled businesses. The only way someone would not want to talk to me who was going to invest in the company would be if someone had said something negative about me.
Yeah.
That's the only way, because any search online, any search in any records would show no lawsuits, no problems, beautiful relationships, beautiful written communications, two published books that were not the bestsellers, but I think gave an impact to those that read. So part of what I wanted to talk to you about when I was in the fall was trying to think of writing together was and I couldn't figure out what it was, but there was this feeling that I was having about you and I having these dialogues of discovery as two middle-aged men. I don't mean to
come
put
on,
this moniker.
Man. Come on, let's as two thinkers, two seekers. You know, people who reflect on life.
There was, but I think the indicator was that there was enough experience that there was some. There was not what we see nowadays on Instagram is coaches, right?
Yes.
All these people at 22, 24, 25 years old, all becoming coaches, going to try to help me guide my life. Now, I mean no disrespect for their attempts and their gain, but if you think of the five stages of learning, novice, apprentice, craftsman, expert, master, you at 24 and 25, you're still making your way through. I was that way also. You just are. So having these interesting, emotional, vulnerable, considered conversations at our age as men is something that there's a dearth of. Because either you have to portray yourself as an A-type, alpha, powerful, accomplished, take control sort of person, or you're this overly sensitive, sort of softer sort of person, and people, they want to hear about how to get rich, how to be powerful, how to be the rest of stuff. But there's an entire constituency of men and women, I would imagine, but only speaking for men, who are looking for this inspiration. I find it all the time when people want to talk to me on airplanes. My turban is like, it's like being a priest in so much as it creates an aura for people to want to confess to. I have more people.
I want to confess to you. Yeah.
People, they want to share their lives. They want to show me pictures. They don't show other people. They want to tell me about their fears. They just have this sort of space. And so as a hairy, head covered man, lots of people want to sort of, there's a feeling that they wind up having. And I thought, oh, well,
there's a bit of a guru in there.
Yeah, which is a weird thing, of course, because I
which
see,
is true, you know, by the way.
Well, certainly my dress is like the guru, but my heart is my heart may try, but my life isn't quite there yet. But
I want you to tell me that story of converting to Sikhism when you were in your 20s. But first, I would say for coaches, I think that the reality of coaches is that it's a very interesting double negative in a very interesting way, because coaching, as it is taught, is not supposed to give advice. It's just supposed to ask the right questions, right?
That's right.
And so, and so perhaps as a younger person, curiosity is a very innate skill that you have. And so accordingly, you may become a very good coach by asking the better questions, right? And and in that sense, as long as you conform to the coaching scope, then perhaps that's amazing. But I actually happen to disagree a little bit with the scope itself, because in an interesting way, I think that sometimes the person that's being coached has such a clear challenge that they're unable to see. And yet the coach continues to ask questions until they see it themselves, when a person like you or I, who has seen it 200,000 times in our lives, would go and say, have you noticed A, B, and C? Like, by the way, the reason you're thinking this way is because you look at it this way. Have you considered that? So rather than just an open question, you would tend to offer a solution or a nugget of wisdom of some sort. Tell me about that conversion story. I didn't know that you converted when you were in your 20s.
Yeah, so I grew up in a traditional Reformed Jewish household. I like to call us apples and honey Jews, which meant they celebrated during Rosh Hashanah.
And where?
I was in New England.
Okay.
And when my family immigrated to America, they'd come from Eastern Europe and Prussia and Ukraine sort of area there. Though when I did my DNA right after COVID, it showed the migratory pattern of the Jewish people as to the Ashkenazi Jews, as opposed to 23andMe says, oh, you're 50% Ashkenazi Jew. That's the extent of it. This other service I used out of Hong Kong, they said, oh, you were Middle Eastern, 40%. 40% Southern European, you were 7% Eastern European, and I was 3% Northern Territory Chinese.
Wow.
And I'm the only one in the history of my family that was 3% Chinese. So one of two things happened. Mm-hmm. Either the consumption of wacky wok in abundance during COVID changed my DNA, which I think may be entirely possible, or the Chinese government owns this service and they're trying to seed the population by having people grow more sensitivity to having a little Chinese in them.
With all due respect, but also another possibility is that one of your great grandma, moms was a little naughty, but that we're not going to talk about that.
I think that it's possible that some military man came through the village.
Exactly.
I'm going to lead on the wacky walk story, though.
So, yeah, but you definitely look very Middle Eastern, Southern European, right? Like, you know, you don't come across at all as an Eastern European. You don't come across as an Indian origin. So it's actually quite an interesting mix with the turban. How the way you would fit in society is a bit of a puzzle, really.
Yeah, and so I grew up in an upper middle class Jewish family, had good business acumen around us. My father was in the radio business. My grandfather was in the radio business. They owned radio stations. My uncle's cousins had created a big retail chain of drugstores. Someone else had owned hotels. There was around, but we didn't live a life of abundance. Certainly not. I mean, we lived very comfortable. Don't get it wrong, but not the kind of displays of wealth that we see today. And it was also a different time, and I was in New England. So there was a level of modesty that has sort of existed. When I was a little boy, I came home from school and I cried on the floor. I was 6 years old and I would cry. And I said, I would ask my mother, why did God make me like this and why can't he make it stop? And part of it was this abundance of sensitivity that I have. When I talked to my therapist and I had gone through during COVID, I took on a therapist. I was going to use that particular time to be really mindful. So I deepened my meditative practice. I did therapy twice a week, which I had never done before. I really worked hard to try to go in and figure out a whole bunch of stuff, largely from things that I had built structures around as I got to adulthood that I just didn't have time to indulge in. So I tried to here's a bunch of feelings, here's a bunch of thoughts, here's a bunch of stuff. You're going to have to be over there because I have to produce. I have to support. There's no place for this indulgence. I missed my time to do this, et cetera. My parents were, I think, very typical boomers at the early stage of boomers. So they missed the 60s drug and hippie side of stuff because they graduated around 66 or so. And they did the best they could, but they had no mechanism for being parents. So a lot of times I always tease people that I just didn't have any parents. I just had no help. So my therapist and I had gone through the studies and time. And she said, if you look on the bell curve of highly sensitive people, and I read this fantastic book from this psychologist and researcher in the UK who wrote about highly sensitive people. She said, oh, well, you're at the end of that bell curve. You're way at that. You're at that 1% of 1%. And you're not just sensitive on one aspect. You're across the board. So no one taught me how to deal with it. All this abundance of feeling, the sensitivity, I didn't have any superpowers. I was just open. And it was open that my brain could open the aperture up wide to find connective tissue between things, which is how I was able to be creative. Because I could see things and process things quickly that oftentimes had to the intellectual walls that people built up or the shoulds and supposed tos, I just didn't have as much there. And at the same time, I was also pretty risk adverse, which is an interesting part of it. But statistically, entrepreneurs tend to be risk adverse. So I process through life. I get some really great teachers along the way. Mr. Adams in fourth grade, Mr. Clough in fifth grade, Mr. Cotton in seventh grade. Mr. Cotton, I still went back to his schools until he retired to speak to his classes out of just gratitude, because he pulled me aside and he was like, you aren't going to learn anything in my class. You already know this stuff. Here, let me do something. So he started, he had me read Martin Buber. He had me read My Name is Asher Lev by Chaim Potok and talk about it. He had me study Amos's words and how Amos was a different writer than the other parts and where the change was. He had me talking about philosophy and philosophy of science. He met with me after school. He gave me hope,
one of
intellectual
those.
Hope.
One of and those. All we need is one good teacher in our life. Can you believe that?
Yep.
Yeah. For me, for the record, it was Mr. Sawah, which was, you know, I was a serious math geek when I was young. And then I had a very, very bad flu when I was on the 8th grade or something like that. And so I missed 3 weeks of school and basically went back and I was completely lost. I had no idea what was happening in math. You know, they kept moving and so I missed a bit of it. And math builds on itself. So I was struggling. And then I had that private tutor that came in twice a week to our place, to our home, with a big, big bag of colorful pencils. And it was geometry at the time. Trigonometry, you know, the one that's three-dimensional. I don't know what the name is in English. But basically, he would start to draw every line in a different color based on which plane it is in. You know, if it's on the XY plane or the Z plane and so on and so forth. And man, I just could see, like literally, he saved my math brain in 3 weeks, and he was funny like hell. I love that man. He completely changed my life. Absolutely one teacher. You need one good teacher. Sorry, I interrupted you.
I'm glad to share that. It's true. And he was a very like kind of slow moving, a little kaffa, just kind of sweet and kind. He gave me sort of hope. I missed a lot of that growing up. I didn't, as it turns out in the end, there was a lot of parts of me I didn't develop and learn. I was given, I remember telling my daughter once, we had had a weekend together, and I said to her, you know, you and I have had more conversations this weekend than I had in my childhood.
Oh, man.
And so I was mostly alone, and I craved connection. And I craved learning, and I craved someone help me ask questions. That was the thing that you brought it up in the beginning. It was like, I wanted someone to help me. What were the questions to ask? How could you probe me to connect the dot? Now, telling me, hey, have you thought of something like this? Is not solving it for me.
Yeah.
I then go, oh, yeah, what about this, that, this, the rest of stuff? It's like helping me find an insight and then building from the insight, right? So we go along, and through Mr. Cotton's class and then one more class somewhere in high school, I learned about Eastern religion. And I found it really fascinating, but I really wanted to figure out about my Judaism. So I met Rabbi Schneerson, the Lubavitch rabbi, the Rebbe, who was very, very famous. I didn't realize how famous and how like rare it was to meet such a man. I met Elie Wiesel. I met Rabbi Zalman Schechter Shalomi at the Naropa Institute, Rabbi Larry Kushner, and Rabbi Harold Kushner. So we're talking about a pretty wide range of the types of Judaic thinking. And while I related to Judaism as a culture and as a part of my who I was and who many of my friends were, similar upbringing, etc., I never could get into the Judaism as a faith, as an expression of an experience of my heart. I wanted to really, really deeply, but I did not connect to it. And I remained a Jew by culture, but not by faith. I also was, I think they call them an apathist. There was some name that it really spoke to me as I didn't really, I remember meeting one of my mentors said to me, you're the most religious atheist I ever met. I think, but partially I didn't really care if there was God or not, because if there was God or not, isn't going to affect my behavior.
That's a good and interesting point.
And if I was going to have behaviors, I can't have them be, they're not real if I do them because of some fear or something that's outside of me.
No, but that's not what it's supposed to be. The presence of God because I've pondered this quite a bit, actually. It should not influence your behavior. It should influence your intention, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Your intention is, so my daughter, Aya, very, very wise young lady, basically says, if we accept the story that we are made of matter and a spirit, right? Mix them together and then you get a human. Then the matter longs to earth, longs to materialism, longs to dirt, okay? And the spirit longs to divinity. And she basically says, an interesting explanation of most spiritual teachings is, she says, and if you, during your lifetime, refine yourself from the attachment to material things, to matter, to life on this earth, then what's left of you is more of a pure form of divinity, and that pure form of divinity would then return back to its source, basically. So you become God in that definition, whatever God is, which basically is a great explanation of heaven, because the description of heaven is you can get anything you want. That's sort of like the creation abilities of God. It's a good explanation of reincarnation, because basically you're not pure enough. You still have residual karma, so you need to come back and cleanse that from your attachment to materialism. And it's an interesting explanation to a lot of things. And it, when it comes to intention in that case, then basically the right intention is because I'm trying to approach my divinity. Okay, I'm trying to purify myself from my lower instincts and desires and refine myself up to the point where I reach to my divinity. And then the intention becomes different. The actions are exactly the same, but the intention becomes different.
That's a beautiful explanation. And I think now your daughter is about to become my spiritual teacher. So thank her for that.
She's done so much work for a 28-year-old.
Now I just need to know where to bring the two coconuts and the hazelnut. the place in front of her.
We all know who's the teacher here. Huh? Thanks for the humbleness, but we all know who the teacher is here in this sitting. Yeah.
You know, there's a concept in Sikhism about the true beloved, the reference to my true beloved.
Yeah,
God,
Sufism, right? As well. Yeah,
I never understood what true beloved meant until I looked in my daughter's eyes, and then I've always called her my true beloved. So that's when I really understood it. And that's always been. She had two nicknames. I called her Monster Pants and my true beloved. Anyway, but you're right about intention. It's sort of embedded in there. It's like, I just realized the bigger thing was I have no concept to understand in the infinite. I watch all these great videos on YouTube about astrophysics, about the discovery of new universes, about this small slither and the concept of an ever expanding and into what and creating. And the whole, I was listening to some scientists the other day and they said, what's the most amazing thing? He goes, the fact that I can't understand how big and vast and everything that sort of exists is. So I realized the same thing about God was more of just like, I can't understand. So I'm just going to try to be
100%.
Whatever.
That's actually the pure spiritual connection is to say that's beyond my understanding. I believe there is a higher power, but that's beyond my understanding.
Yeah. And that was my thing. And in one of the Sikh Shabads, it talks about how if you were to begin in Japji, the first prayer of the morning, it says, if you were to begin upon your first breath and repeat lakhs and lakhs of times, which is lakh is a function of 100,000, lakhs and lakhs of time. Even upon your last breath, you wouldn't know an iota of God's greatness.
Absolutely.
And so, and they also talk about how a grain of sand can't even understand the vastness of its own beach, let alone the beaches of the world, of this one planet. So, but I still had this yearning of wanting to understand, of also, I think home, a feeling of home, which I didn't really have. I had a home, I had structure, we had food, we had the rest of stuff, but emotionally, I never had home. Mm. And therefore, I never really had safe. It never felt safe. Therefore, I also never understood intimacy. I never understood connection. I learned these things and I trusted myself to build them. But when I went through this period of reflection later on, I realized how much of that foundation I could really retrofit for earthquakes. That was not retrofitted, so to speak. And so go backwards 40 years, 35 years or so, I started a business that sold antique replica baseball hats called the Hat of the Month Club. Now, I had been doing a couple different businesses. I started this home delivery, which was essentially the first seamless Grubhub in the country, where first it was room service for your home. So it was called Evening, Spend a Night Out at Home. And I went to the old milk companies hood, and they had those silver boxes that you would leave outside your house where they would bring the milkman, milk person, I guess mostly men at the time, milkmen would bring milk and leave it outside your house. Then you'd bring your milk in, you'd leave the old bottles for them to retrieve. I bought some of them, I repainted them. And then I said, okay, you know what we're going to do is we're going to have people order in advance. There was no such thing as food delivery in 1986, just other than crappy pizza. And we're going to deliver Nouvelle Cuisine food, or 97, 87, whatever, Nouvelle Cuisine food to people's homes. So now they could have beautiful food delivered to the house on China, and then they'll just leave the dirty dishes outside. Well, amazing. It didn't really work, and it wasn't really cost effective. And it was, I'm doing it in my apartment. And it was like, but so then I converted it to, I went to these restaurants and said, give me your menus. I'll put them in a book and I'll do the delivery. We'll add 15% to your menu and you'll give me 15, 10%.
You created Deliveroo in 1986.
Yeah, 1987. Hey, by the way, my seventh grade science project was essentially TiVo, because I kept missing goals while watching hockey, and I was like, why can't I just rewind it? So I built a tape system, like an answering machine that recorded on a loop. So long as you watched it within the 5 minutes afterwards, you could rewatch your thing. And it was technologically a mess. It was technologically a mess. And I wasn't a techno person. I was just an idea person. So anyway, I have this issue. I was with this girlfriend, and I woke up at 3 a.m. and I realized to myself, if I become rich right now, I'm going to be a terrible human being.
That's a very, very eye-opening realization, my friend.
Yeah, it was. And I hadn't done anything wrong. I just watched my behavior. I could feel it. So I gave the company to the partner that I have, the business, and I went on a walkabout, but I never really went anywhere. I only walked to the natural food store in Providence, Rhode Island, called the Golden Sheaf. And I somehow wanted to go read the New York Times and have a scone and have a cup of green tea in the morning. And natural foods at that time was pretty old school. I mean, it basically smelled like nutritional yeast and vinegar. It's basically what a natural food store smelled like, and body odor. And I met a Sikh man walked in the door. He was a sales rep for an organization called CBB. And his name was Shiva Singh. Shiva in the Hindu tradition is the destroyer or the liberator. But destroyer, not, I think, as Western minds think of destroying as in destruction, but as in the sort of breaking down to rebuild, to liberate. Mm. Mm. And we started chatting. And we started talking on the phone. And I started asking him a lot of questions. And one day he said to me, I don't really understand all these questions that you ask, and your brain doesn't work like my brain. And so you should go have your own experience. So you should write the letter to this man, Yogi Bhajan, and you should go to, there's a Buddhist temple around in this area, and there's a Sikh temple. You should go visit them and see what it feels like. So I went to the Buddhist temple, and it was really lovely. It wasn't my vibration or my energy, but I really appreciated it. And it was delightful. But again, it didn't have the anchors that I related to as much or felt through. But when I heard the Shabads, the songs of Sikhism, the poems set to rag, the rhythm, in the Sikh scriptures, I believe there are 36 different rags, or I think that the English translation would be like pentameter, wouldn't it? Essentially. Like an iambic pentameter, like a rhythm of a poem. Mm-mm. So I think rag is sort of similar to that. I was always trying to figure out what the similarity is, but it's and there's morning rags, and there's midday rags, and there's evening rags. And I heard Dana Dana Guru Ram Das, and I cried, and it just felt like home. And over time, I learned to tie a turban and became a Sikh, and really, really found a home in it, even as an atheist, so to speak. But the concept of the free kitchen, the concept of the consciousness of what Guru Nanak and the gurus taught, the balance between the soldier and saint, the concept of carrying my kirpan, my knife, as a reminder that it's my duty to defend others' rights to live as they choose. It's not for my own defense. It's for me to have a mechanism. And the hope that my heart is the sword, that my tongue is the sword, that my projection is the sword, that the last thing on earth we ever wish to do is to draw the sword, which is why it's very traditional in Sikhi that if you are to take your kirpan out of its sheath, you must cut yourself or draw blood with it as a referent, as relationship to, you only draw it at the last purpose. Now, of course, I'm not a cutter and I don't have cuts all over my body, nor do I take my kirpan off, but understanding that the consciousness behind that, or that sort of spoke to the free kitchen, that before anyone could go see the gurus, the 10 Sikh teachers, starting with the third one and Guru Amar Das, you took langar. Whether you were Aurangzeb, the Muslim leader, or you were a leper, you were a shepherd, you all sat together and you ate. And then you saw the guru. It didn't matter who you were. There are two things. We all needed breath, and that made us all exactly the same. And food was the other need, and it should be shared and without ownership. And every day at the Golden Temple, just one of the Sikh temples, the one in Amritsar, some people call it the sort of Vatican of Sikhism. It's not really that, because there's five seats of Sikhism, but it's the most understood and the most seen visual, because it's golden, it's big, it's in the water, it's an extraordinary thing. There's four doors to the temple to signify that all walks of life are welcome from every direction. The only requirement to be there is to cover your head and to not be intoxicated, two seemingly easy things to overcome. And that's the free kitchen, the Guru Ram Das free Lunger Hall, which every day serves 100,000 people meals of vegetables, of dal, of rice, of chapati, of yogurt, of tea and biscuits, 100% donated, 100% of the wood, 100% of the legumes, the grains, the wheat, the vegetables, all prepared by hand, all donated, all offered for free. No one is paid. And that's at one temple that people get to sit together and just eat. And the wealthy and the poor are all the same. And so
amazing, really.
I wore my turban and just became and realized it was like being a cup of water reunited with the ocean. And so for me, that was the feelings. There was no reaction to being something that I wasn't. I still identify as Jewish. And I'll tell you this funny story. There was this wealthy real estate developer. I won't mention his name because he was mean to me. I met him and through another investor of mine, and we had lunch at the Pierre Hotel. And we were sitting there, two very, very wealthy, very, very wealthy men. One had pledged, one had offered, given me $1 million. Then we went to his friend. And this man says to me, you know, I don't understand what's going on here. He reaches his hand across the table and he puts his hand about this far from my face. I don't really get what's going on here. You sound like this, but you look like that. I'm all confused. I don't know what's up. He wasn't being mean. He was like, whatever. He's in his 70s. And so he was just being free to speak. And I said, well, sir, here's the thing. I grew up as a Jew and I loved being a Jew, but I didn't resonate to it on the religious and on the practice side. And I discovered Sikhism. So religiously, I'm a Sikh and I love it. Economically, I'm still a Jew and I love that too. And he goes, okay, I'll give you $500,000. Many of my friends are my best friend, either Sikh or Jewish. And one of my best friends in LA, who was one of the creators of Ticketmaster Online, and a really beautiful brain. We're like two old Jews walking down the street to go to Bagel Nosh for breakfast together. The only thing we're not complaining about is our sciatica. But otherwise, we're basically my grandfather and his best friend. So that was my conversion.
And then you spent 30 years learning.
Yeah, it's
right?
Been 30 years. I think it was about 20. I was probably about 24. Or so, 23. My transition was starting when I was 23 or 24, and I'm 56. So
there was a period, I read that online because I stalked you a little bit. There was a period where you would meditate for 3 hours or do yoga for 3 hours a day for 6 years in a row or something like that.
Yeah, I did the morning sadhana. And so I was up at 3:45 in the morning. I read Japji. And then I would do yoga, and then we would meditate for 62 minutes. And then if I had enough time, I would sit at temple. I still meditate every day, and it's mostly breath now, though I love to chant. And if I have a gong available around me, then I might play the gong or listen to the gong being played, which I find to be a really beautiful. But music, mantra, and kirtan, every morning when I put my turban on, and every morning when I'm getting ready, I the music from the Golden Temple streams, and I'm listening to this evening's music because it's the evening there now. And I am Jagat Jyoti, and that's what I've always related to much more than the earlier. I've been a Sikh longer than I was not a Sikh.
What was it before Jagat Jyoti?
I never really say so that it doesn't wind up creating confusion.
Don't say it.
I don't share it because then it creates duality for people looking at me, uh-huh. And then they wind up debating which one it was. But my family name when we came over in the late 1800s was Kalvamanovich.
Okay.
And the man in front of us at Ellis Island, who we had met on the boat, said to my great grandfather, "I told them we were together, so you're all set." So therefore, we lost our name, and our name became Leon, because his uh-huh. name was Leon. Oh. And then when my grandfather on my father's side, like my family name on my mother's side was Gottlieb, which translates in German to God loves. And on my father's side, it was Leon. And then it became, the S was added to it for lions when he was in seventh grade, because his teacher said, "Since there's more than one person in your family, shouldn't you have a plural?" And so we wound up becoming a plural as a result of my grandfather's seventh grade teacher. And the other thing that Sikhism did for me was it gave a visual to my weirdness. So is for lack of a better, I was different and thought differently and had a different language pattern and processed life differently, not by any architecture or good or bad, not comparing good or bad to anyone else, just different. And having a turban gave it context for people.
Oh, interesting.
I became much better understood. They were like, oh yeah. Like I felt my appearance was congruent with my oddness.
then you're rested in it. You're like, okay, that's me. I'm okay with it. You know what's really interesting? Every time we speak about this, is I will have to think about this deeply. I do not recall any major transformations in my life. I was always very gradual, very, you know, I morphed every day a little bit from a very shrewd, very temperamental, very aggressive, greedy young man to what I am now. But it's always been very, very, you know, you almost couldn't feel the transitions. They were just constant everyday transitions, which is quite interesting. I think the only big transition in my life was when Ali died. And then I chose to be an author and a champion 1 billion happy rather than be a businessman anymore. But other than that, you know, the idea of going to India and going to the Golden Temple and sitting with teachers and making a choice, I don't think I ever did that, ever, which is a very interesting way of life, I think.
Actually, I don't think we're not that dissimilar. The Sikhi was about the only big shift, and it was really because my GPS coordinates were off. I just was on the wrong road, and all of a sudden, then when I took the wrong road, then it progressed without a lot of fanfare. I wasn't a particularly, I didn't have a very drama-filled life, and not a lot of quick, jerky movements. And I changed a lot of things. I did a bunch of stuff, and some of it was on a hunt for. I think a lot of it actually, I was a really sensitive, gentle kid. My father was relatively loud. I think he had really bad anxiety and he had really bad behavior and reactions, not physically damaging in any way, but very loud. And I wasn't really loud, though I developed, this is what I learned to be, which I've shifted, but it's all that I grew up seeing. And thankfully for my aunt, my grandfathers, they were gentle. But that those days of asking God why he made me like that was part of it was because you and I were born at the same time, though in different parts of the world, so different cultural experiences. But I think we may both acknowledge, particularly at the early stage of this Gen X, there was not a lot of promotion to lead with your heart.
Oh, not at all.
And
demonized. And
And then there was, you would be excoriated for doing it. You'd be accused of stuff. You'd be projected at stuff. There'd be a whole bunch of stuff that I just didn't buy into. So I walked that line between being heart and being a jock. I played ice hockey. I played tennis. I didn't relate to any of those boys. I related to the other kids, but I didn't really relate to one particular constituency. I was connected to all, most. But I didn't, it took me a long time to get to a space. When I did my book, I'm Down With You, the portraiture book from Down Syndrome, it was me also saying, hey, I'm going to start leading with my heart more. And I started realizing everything I wind up creating is really in my heart. That's why I didn't go to Starbucks or Unilever or these other sort of big companies. I wanted I just kept searching for, can I build something? Can I do something organic? Can I do something good for people and planet? Can I, the Down Syndrome book, all of the books I've ever come up with, all the concepts, all the philanthropic things I want to do or create, it was always against what can I do for people. I like that the satisfaction of that and the fulfillment of it. And I always wanted to find a partner. I never found the partner, the creative partner. I have some, but someone who was a real, I have it now in this new company, partially because he lets me be me and he gets to be him. And it's a really nice compliment. I'm a really wonderful number two person, but when you're in the Gen X,
you're
pushed to be the number one. The alpha, you're pushed to be the leader and the rest of the stuff. You're pushed to be the CEO. I don't actually want to. I've been it, but I don't actually like it. I like being behind the scenes. I like the work of moving everything along quietly without the fanfare, without the monikers, I don't care about the credit. I used to say, I don't take credit for my own work and neither can you. Because people would take credit for, I don't care. But that was, none of that stuff was promoted when I was a kid. The soft part of being number two. You know, I used to fantasize about being, I'll confess to you, I don't think I've ever said it out loud to anyone. I used to think about being a butler when I was a kid.
Oh man, best job ever.
There was something elegant about the anticipating someone's needs and taking care of them and giving somebody all the stuff that I realized in the end, energetically, I never really had an experience of in my youth. And as my adulthood, I sought to understand it. And in my, again, middle ages, I've sought to integrate it and to lead for the rest of my life through my heart. I think that was part of what the conversation was I wanted to have with you about when I was thinking about writing, was about leading through the heart and a permission structure for people to be okay with that. Because it seems to be we've lost that as part of our life. We've just gone to intellect and power and money. And all those things can still be filtered through the heart. But I find the feeling when I talk to the people that I lead at the business, and these are really nice people, and they're very thoughtful, and they're very, and the way they respond to this, to the smallest amount of being seen, which I realized is one of the greatest gifts I can give anyone that I can interact with, is the ability for them to feel seen in totality by me, the wholeness of there, whether they present those parts of themselves or not, but seeing them as a whole and seeing all the parts of them without judging and just speaking to who they are. And they're, when you do that, there seems to be a really beautiful release that happens with people in an exchange. And from that exchange, you get to create intimacy without the fear of intimacy and without it being emotional or unsafe. Because you've begun with, I see you, without having to say, I see you, because I'm speaking to you. not to what you present you are, and not to your brand, but to you. Now, the downside of that is I don't always get the timing right, and it's not always what someone actually wants to live through and live being. They still may have their fears and their anxieties around leading with their heart or doing it. But I find when I talk to people, some of our common friends we met at Robbins and some of the folks and a lot of the Robbins folks, which I really am inspired by. I wrote Tony a really sweet note after that last visit. And I said to him and Sage, going to that event in Mexico was like going to a temple without the conversation, without an altar and without a deity and without a minister, but a collective group of people that were really there doing their best and were willing to put themselves in spaces in front of people, acknowledging behaviors that are societally judged. There was that woman that spoke about her affairs. There was our friend who grew up in abject poverty from India, who spoke of, and he was working on the VR stuff. There was people that were willing to stand up and cry and confess and to be. And I found that space to be as holy as any temple I had ever been to as a result of...
It really was. And I think the mix, the blend of Sage and Tony together is just nuclear, honestly. I mean, they are such an interesting couple because they're very different in their approaches to the same destination. And I think they both hold space very differently. I have to say I was very moved by that event myself. I mean, it's been, to me, when I was going, I was like, I have to say I wasn't very into Tony Robbins' work. I really didn't know it very much, honestly. I knew that he was very good at what he was doing. But then to see people open up that way is magic. Like, you know, there are people that don't open up this way in front of friends or even, you know, loved ones. And then to see them in front of 300, 400 people just opening their heart and saying, and every one of them, you know, would come to me afterwards and we would have a chat and they would, you know, it's just a very unusual, almost temple-like. You're very right. You know, there is a space of safety, a space of this is the time where I can find myself and be open. It was really quite moving, I have to say.
Yeah, I really, you know, I've met Tony in 92. So I saw him with his first wife. I saw him in the early stages of his career. Two of my dearest friends had been hit with him since the early days. And then watched his sort of evolution. And I've always been my experience of Tony has always been really, really genuine.
And yeah, he's very genuine. Yeah.
And really nice. And he has his mechanisms for doing things. I think his ability to take complex concepts, whether it's Kundalini yoga or it's NLP or it's Freudian or Jungian or any number of other studies he brings in, and then his ability to contextualize them and kind of move them into a new space for them, is really, I find quite lovely. But anyway, the experience is really quite lovely. And I think this last 30 years of my life is going to be much more about leading with my heart and figuring and seeing where that winds up taking me, what I wind up creating with that.
So here is what got me really close to you. So you were at Tony's event, sort of teaching meditation and mindfulness and, you know, inviting people to introspect and go within and so on and so forth, right? And then we meet over that breakfast afterwards. And I'm expecting, you know, especially with your look, Mr. Turban, I'm sitting with Mr. Guru, right? And you're a shrewd businessman. Like, no, seriously, like you've started businesses in health and organic food and, you know, most of those things before they became things, right? And you sold several companies and so on, right? And you're still, when you're looked at, you're just honestly not interested in life. You seem that you're not interested in this material life at all. That duality is quite interesting for me. You come across as the most gentle human being alive, And yet you make decisive business decisions and, you know, you start businesses and you end businesses and right? That duality is very interesting for me. I really have to say it's very rare to find that.
Well, it's interesting that that's your view. It's true. I've been a part of companies that have built and grown and have been at early stages of a lot of parts of stuff. You know, I joined Max McKenzie and Tyler Florence to launch the first baby food in a pouch, Sprout Baby Food. And we were ahead of stuff. Yogi Tea, I joined early and really scaled it in the cereal business, which we ultimately sold and baby food company sold. But I didn't, you know, I like business and I'm really enjoying this new thing, this new one that I joined very, very much. And I realized the reason that I really enjoy it is I can find success. The measures of what success is in business. And so long as I can stay accomplishing those, the measurement of success that the private equity firm that owns this new company wants, or my friend who's the CEO, providing I can keep hitting their metrics and scale the business for its ultimate exit, I then have a place to do the stuff that I really find fulfilling, which is to have each of the people that have sat in those cubicles that for sometimes 18 or 20 years have been very poorly acknowledged. And I remember talking to this team the other day, and I had lunch. They had lunch for the first time. And afterwards, there was one person who's I had heard has been very negative. The person's been there for many, many years. And is starting to be a little jaded. And a little negative. And I think some of the information that has been provided or she's gathered along the way is not wholly accurate. And she pulled me aside the other day and she said, I don't know what it was, but there's something that shifted and we're all looking at each other differently. And people are stopping and giggling more often. And there she goes, it just started when we just ate together. And I remember that's the longer haul. It just started when we ate together, because when you sit and eat with somebody, it's almost impossible to hate them. It's almost impossible to be mad at somebody when you're sitting there sharing food. It's one of the reasons why I love pizza. I love pizza, of course, because it's the greatest food in the world. That's true.
Look at you with all the healthy, you know, healthy food stuff.
That's true. But what it does, it's something that nothing else does. When a pizza shows up at a house or in an office, everybody wants to watch it open up. It's like the jack-in-a-box of food. And no one runs to the kitchen to go look at the pad thai when you open the container, right? But they all want to see what the pizza looks like. But the thing that I love most about pizza is that everybody can have a piece of pizza at the exact same moment, at the exact same temperature, so long as there's the requisite amount of slices for the amount of people. Let's just say six slices for six people. Though I always remember Yogi Berra saying once, he goes to a pizza place and they said, hey, Yogi, do you want it cut into six or eight pieces? He says, you better make it six. I'm not that hungry. And but there's an equality amongst pizza that no other food shares, because we get to eat it at the same time with who we share it with, at the same temperature, at the same moment. We don't have to pass it. We don't have to worry about what our portion is. We don't have to worry about leaving enough for anyone else. It's just there and we can all be together. And so the food part, while as important as part of why we gathered, gets pushed aside and becomes less important than the gathering of the people and the souls together and the dialogues, discovery, and exchanges that you can have when you're not starting the first 10 minutes passing food around a table, trying to see who else is eating, how much we have to leave. There's no interpretation. It's just food arrives and there it is. And now we can be together.
Yeah, it's like getting for dinner as a family, a tradition that used to make family is now not happening anymore, or honestly, the way friends used to be. It's quite interesting how it changed those habits, because I have to say that you're absolutely right. Just breaking bread with someone is definitely an interesting way to connect, right?
And the truth is, if I had enough money, just plenty of just stacks of cash, I would probably spend my whole life building the Fair Share program, the food for. I had this concept of doing this food, which we still written. I actually sent it to Tony and offered it to him, called Fair Share. and it was 30 staple items, organic staple items for a 4-foot set in the grocery store, so 4 feet wide, a row, that every fifth package that sold, this an equivalent of the sixth was given to the food bank in the state where you're, where you, it was purchased. So I said it was like inviting your neighbor to dinner without setting the table. Essentially, what I eat, you eat. So none of this like, hey, I'm going to give string beans and pumpkin pie filling to the food bank. None of this food that I'm grateful that the large companies give that are largely nutrientless and dilapidated value of food, but healthy organic food. Because what I learned in Oregon, for instance, many years ago, was that 85% of the people that use our food banks are working poor, that they don't have enough food dollar days to make it for the whole month. And so we've created, right? And so I thought, well, let me create this sort of program. And so it's a, it's basically a, well, I called it the first public brand as opposed to private brand or business brand. It was a public brand. It was a brand for the people. And there was a quote that I put on the front of the deck, and if, and if, I paraphrased it, but it said, I want to ask God why he allows so much famine, disease, and hunger in our world, and why he doesn't do anything about it, but I'm afraid he'll ask me the same question.
I was going to answer you that way.
I'm sure you would.
So one of the statistics that kill me, is that for every malnourished human on the planet, which of which I think there is around a billion now, there is one obese person on the planet, of which there is around a billion now. So it's quite interesting that it, you know, if you leave it to nature or to God, no, nature and God are providing. It's just we're distributing it wrong, right?
That's right.
And it's quite shocking when you really look at the amount of food that is that goes to waste as garnish, the amount of food that goes to waste just because portions in restaurants have to look big when no one's going to eat them, the amount of food that goes to waste because you have to have a meal choice on a flight and so on and so forth. And it is just staggering. Of course, I couldn't miss the opportunity to talk about the amount of food that goes to really literally be destroyed just to keep the prices fixed. And in reality, the world provides, life provides. It's just that we humans are quite mean sometimes.
We have enough ability to grow and feed those that are hungry on the planet without a single rich person losing a dollar.
Absolutely.
Not one company would have any less revenue if we fed all them, because those people that are hungry in our world are not buying Doritos anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
And we don't want them eating Doritos. You know what? Someone asked me, I'm really quite religious about tracking my food. So I track everything that I eat, and I eat 1,500 calories a day. And one of the ways people are, oh, that's pretty neurotic of you. And I go, no, it's not, because I like data. But it's not neurotic because what I do is I was really craving like junk food the other day. I was like, I want something like salty and overflavored, you know, some sort of chip or something. And I realized the small bag of chips was 390 calories.
Wow.
Right? So 390 calories is about 27 or 28% of my daily caloric intake. But that bag of chips was not going to last me 27 or 28% of my day. It was only going to last me about 10% of my day, and then I'd be hungry again. And so I chose not to eat it as a result.
Yeah, and it would have also made you crave more of it. So, yeah.
That's right. And so I believe there was in that. I created a project. I've outlined a project for Alzheimer's, because I realized that the average Alzheimer's patient loses about 200 of our family stories into their brains as the disease progresses. We're losing all the oral history and all the stories. So we came up with this program. We didn't do anything with it. We've outlined it, called A Billion Stories. And basically it was Facebook for the family. It was just basically an app-based thing where you would capture audio, video. You'd have a teleprompter so you could interview your family member and ask effective questions, to take pictures, to have quotes, to get audio, to have this one social place for all of your family stories. So forever, we would have a database of our family stories that could ultimately be anonymized and shared, because we're losing these stories of perseverance, of love, of romance, of our transfer. We're losing all this stuff because social media, is like fish, right? It just lasts a day before it starts to stink or go away, right? It's just like, I don't mean any judgment from it. It's just like, it's not really, there's no longevity to it. And it's not searchable. Have you ever tried to go back in Facebook and find anything that you've posted? It's an impossible feat to do. So there was that project. There was this other one that I created during, just before COVID, that I wish that I had. This is where I really disappoint myself, because I didn't know what to do. I didn't have anyone around me to give it to. I created this program called A Love Story. And it came from the fact that that when my friends are having bad days, one of the things that I've done for them is I read to them. Mm. And I'll choose a book or I'll read something. It could be Osho talking about The True Name, which is his book on the Sikh scriptures, Japji, which is extraordinary. It's the most beautiful. Or another story or fiction or whatever. And I created this app, this concept of this app, which was basically a way, it was YouTube met Audible. It was a place for you to have a public or private channel to read to people. So if I couldn't sleep one night and I just wanted to be read to, I could just go on. I envisioned also being able to take an audio test that lets you evaluate and learn which pitch and temper and tone and et cetera really vibrated with you and really resonated with you. So you could then search the database, the app, for all the people who have that audio marker that makes you feel
relaxed. Such a Californian man.
And then you could just be read to. And then people like my daughter who have to read, let's just say, the Iliad, and she doesn't want to, right? And so she could send invites to all of her friends to come to this one channel. And they could take turns reading to each other, and it would record it so that if someone didn't make it, they could come back and catch up. Or a group of, like, my wife and some of her friends read a book. So imagine them having a book club, an audio book club. I didn't know how to make it because I'm not in the technology world, and I didn't have anyone in the tech world to talk to. But all the projects that I wind up dreaming up are that kind of thing. It's about solving something that's really simple. I'm not going to change the world from solving a cancer or solving things that are meaningful. And I listen to these think tank friends of mine, and I hear the philosophies and their theories, and all this work and all this stuff is way much too heady for my simple, I used to call myself a simple shopkeeper, my simple mind that tries to distill it down to. But I think change can be that sort of one-on-one. And so just hearing someone read can give a sense of peace, a moment, making sure that we have people fed, making sure we save what we're losing in the minds without judgment, without fighting a bad thing, just solving a nice thing.
I've been avoiding the tech side of it, but for a while now, I've been really committing myself, but failing to start the idea of what I call bedtime stories. So a daily podcast or some kind of a way to distribute one 15-minute story to hear before you sleep, which has a bit of, you know, nature sounds in the background or whatever, a bit of meditation at the end. But then, you know, the idea is, I get so many people saying, your voice puts me to sleep. One of the most interesting comments that I ever get is like, oh, I play your audiobooks before I sleep. It makes me sleep. I'm like, oh, seriously, are they that boring? Like, what am I doing wrong? Anyway,
I have to admit to you, what I've been
struggling with is finding those fables. I want those wise wisdom stories, and I have a few of them, but I never dedicated myself to finding them. So for my listeners, guys, if you know nice wisdom stories, Rumi or, you know, the Buddha or anything really, you know, Stoicism, send them my way, please. I think that would be a nice idea.
There's a great story, actually. I'll forward it to you because I don't remember the exactness and I don't want to mess it up. But it was in Osho's book.
Yeah.
And he talks about, it was written by Tagore, who's one of my favorite poets. And I don't know what it is about Tagore's writing, but there's something so magical. How about I read it quickly to you? Do I have a moment to do
so? Yeah, of course.
So Tagore wrote this beautiful poem, and he says, I in quotes, since infinite births, I've been seeking God. I do not know how many paths I have trodden, how many religious orders. God only knows how many doors I have knocked on, how many gurus I served, and how many yogas and penance I performed. One day, however, I ultimately succeeded in reaching his door. I used to get glimpses of him, though, but that would be as near as some distant star. By the time I reached there, the star had long gone by. But today I stand before his gate. I read the name outside. It is his. I climb the steps so overjoyed that the destination is reached. I hold the knocker. I'm about to knock, and then a fear catches hold of me. What if the door opens? What will I do then? And if I do meet God, what then? What will I do next? Till now, there was only one aim in life, to attain God. Then there will be no more goal to work for. Till now, there was only one obsession, one occupation. It will all be destroyed. And what when I have met him? Then there will be nothing left to do, no future to look forward to, no journey to undertake, nothing for the ego to work on. Fear made me tremble. I quietly put the knocker down. So gently did I let it go, for fear lest a slight jerk may cause a sound and the door might open. Then I removed my shoes so that I could go down the steps noiselessly. Then I ran. I ran for my very life, so to say, and never even looked back once. I am still searching for him. You will find me searching for him on different paths, though I know full well where he abides. And yet I ask others where I can find him. And I know where he stays. I seek him even now. Far away near the moon and stars, I catch a glimpse of him. But now I am confident because I know he will have gone far, far away by the time I arrive. Now I seek him in all the places save one, where he abides, and I never go anywhere near it. I guard myself only from him.
That is brilliant. Isn't that exactly what we do?
Mm-hmm. That's
that
right.
That is brilliant.
We seek and we set to obtain the goal that we know if we obtain, we fear will be nothing left to obtain, even though the whole story misses what the attainment and what the moment winds in, that there's more than what you get to see. But I know that struck me because that was me for some time.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, there was the seeking for it, but there was the fear of being it. I know for many years, for a long time, I really avoided and fought being the space of my heart that who it was I was, because then I would have to be different, and it was already lonely as it was. And now what lonely would be there, except that I missed the whole point and it was all the wrong inputs. But when I read that a long time ago, it really struck me, and it also further cemented how extraordinary I found Tagore's writing, like Mirabai, like Rumi. The capacity that they had to write about love is just something I don't know English has ever accomplished.
I think we'll leave it at that. I think I will leave everyone to think a little bit about this conversation. So for everyone listening today, you have been invited to one of my conversations with my dear friends. We had no objective whatsoever, no conversation targets, nothing to specifically get inside your head, just two old men chatting. Isn't that what you said at the beginning, my friend? So there we are. I hope that you enjoyed being with us for this. I hope that you found a few nuggets of wisdom, and I truly, truly hope that you will actually knock the door when you get closer to where you want to be. Because for most of us, we fear who we want to be. And I think that's really, really a key to finding happiness in life. Jagatjoti, I am so, so pleased that you joined me today. It's been a long time in the making, and I definitely think we shouldn't keep it that long next time. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Mo.
And for all of you listening, I hope you felt the pace of our conversation today slower than the pace of your day. I hope you remember that regardless of how busy you are today, there's always a tiny bit of time to slow down, I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.